We made this.
You're listening to Free with this month's issue. As always, please support the bands and artists featured in each episode by buying their records and going to their gigs. Each episode we'll be adding all available tracks to our ongoing Spotify playlist, which you can find on WeDigPodcast.com. You can also find our other episodes and podcasts there. If you want to agree with us, or more likely argue with us, or even appear in a future episode, you can find us on Twitter at This Month's Issue and Facebook at Free with This Month's Issue. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, then let people know. Like, subscribe, review it on iTunes, tattoo it on your forehead, etc. Right, let's get on with it then. Hello, welcome to Free With This Month's Issue, the podcast where we listen to an old free CD, tape, or in this case, record, from old magazines such as Enemy, Kerrang, Q, that kind of thing. My name's Colin, and with me as always is my comrade and co-host Ian.
Hello.
And Ian, we have a guest with us, don't we?
Yes, we do. In fact, we have the oldest guest we've ever had.
Well, that makes sense because we've got the oldest releases we've ever had.
Yes, so thematically correct.
Yes.
It is LT Bag herself, Tracy, from We Dig Music.
Hello.
Our other podcast.
Yes.
Hi, Tracy.
She's been here before.
Hello, yes, nice to be back.
Are you deliberately trying to sound like an old person?
That's just her voice.
Is this the first time you've done records?
Yes.
On Free With This Month's Issue?
It
is. Oh, my God.
We've got two releases on this particular episode because they're both quite short. So what's the first one that you've picked that we're going to talk about today, Tracy?
It's from 1988, and it was an EP that came free with Sounds magazine, and it's Soundwaves 2. It was the second in a series of three, I believe.
Hence the name Soundwaves 2.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know that there was another one after it just because it was called 2, would you?
True. No, I knew because I checked on Discogs, but not everybody listening will have done such diligence.
Mm. And I only actually had number 2. I didn't get Soundwaves 1 because not nearly as interesting. That had Motorhead, Stupid, Creator and Celtic Frost.
Wow, Celtic Frost.
Yeah, so Sounds was the magazine that Kerrang emerged from. Kerrang was originally a supplement in Sounds.
I didn't know that.
The early 80s. Yes, it was. So Sounds was sort of in between Melody Maker and Kerrang, basically, for its sort of music genres. It's not a magazine I've ever read. It was published from 1970 through to 1991.
I didn't often buy Sounds, actually. I bought it especially for this single. I don't know why I didn't get the next one, though, because Soundwaves 3 had the Sugar Cubes, the Wedding Present, Pixies and the Pogues on, which is definitely me.
Well, they got the Wedding Present on it, which would have put me off, but... So, it was released in March 1988. So, music news at the time. Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror from his Bad record tops the Billboard chart, marking the first time in history that a solo artist has had four number one singles from the same album. And Alice Cooper almost dies on stage when the safety device failed on his gallows prop, almost hanging him for real until he's cut down by roadies, which he then went on to play the rest of the gig because he's a fucking badass.
Yep.
Albums released that month, Prefab Sprout from Langley Park to Memphis, Morrissey, Viva Hate, Talking Heads, Naked, Pixies, Surfer Rosa, Bros, Push, Throwing Muses, House Tornado, Pete Murphy, Love Hysteria, and Chicone Youth, the Whitey album, which is a Sonic Youth side project where they did an awesome cover of Into the Groovy by Madonna.
Into the Groovy.
That's the correct name of the song.
Yeah, that is what it was called.
Really?
Yeah.
Into the Groovy.
Everyone just calls it Into the Groove, but it's Into the Groovy, not Into the Gravy. That would be weird. On tour that month, All About Eve, The Fall, House of Love, AC/DC supported by Dokken, and Def Leppard and Heart, but not on the same tour. Number one single, which I definitely remember this being number one at the time, was I Should Be So Lucky by Kylie Minogue. And the number one album was Introducing the Hard Line, according to Terence Trent D'Arby. In the magazine, there was Bjork and Einar from the Sugar Cubes on the cover, And unfortunately, that's the extent of my knowledge, because it got ordered from eBay nearly 3 weeks ago, and I had to get a refund because it's got lost in the post.
Oh, no.
So I still haven't read an issue of Sounds yet. But I've got the other one that we're talking about later, so that's fine.
And in fact, less than 48 hours after recording this episode, my copy of Sounds did arrive in the post. So, in this particular issue of Sounds, Mark Knopfler has recorded the soundtrack to a new movie called The Princess Bride. There's a new story about the UK charts having the biggest indie explosion since punk, with the latest singles by Kylie Minogue and Bomb the Bass. Not he'd normally think of as indie, but they were both on indie labels. There are interviews with Voivod, Heart, and the Sugar Cubes, who are on the cover, where Einar from the Sugar Cubes claims to be a ghost. And then on the singles review page, they've got the absolute audacity to give a glowing review to Sounds Waves 3, the cover mount EP that comes free with the next week's issue.
So, shall we start off with the first track then?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the Jesus and Mary Chain and 9 Million Rainy Days live in Detroit, November 1987. It's a live version of one of the tracks from Darklands, which is the album of theirs that I dig, mainly because the drum machine doesn't sound like it's three rooms away like the drums on Psycho Candy do. Psycho Candy's their absolute classic album, but I've always found it completely unlistenable because of how badly it's recorded.
It didn't change from my usual feeling on bad production. I actually quite like that.
You like it, yeah. Bearing in mind, Psycho Candy came out when I was only 3 years old, and this live version is from when I was five. They're always a band that kind of passed me by. They were sort of seen as the previous generation's band when I was getting into that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not a band that has ever really done much for me. But Tracy, they were a massively significant band for you, weren't they?
Oh, hugely.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw them first on Snub TV, I think, was just blown away by everything, the sound, the image. And then I saw them on, do a few songs on the Whistle Test.
Yeah.
Inner Hole in particular was just amazing.
What was it just about it that grabbed you particularly?
The noise, just the sheer shambling noise of it.
And you switched from being an early teenage Duran Duran to a goth overnight.
I was already listening to loads of gothy stuff through a family friend. I'd already been listening to Susie and the Birthday Party and stuff like that, so...
But it was definitely a fairly pivotal band for you, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Cool. Ian, anything you particularly want to say about Jesus and Mary Chain?
This wasn't quite as noisy as I was expecting it to be.
Yeah.
But,
It's noisier than the album version. The album version is fairly clean.
Yeah.
Particularly the drums, because it's drum machine on the record.
Yeah.
The album version is more like classic 60s girl band sound that they had so much early on. I mean, the album version's even got added almost Stone's Sympathy for the Devil backing vocals through the last chorus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right, let's get on to the next track then.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
So this is Head of David and I Am Roadkill, Rokitansky versus Schwarzenegger live.
Yeah.
Head of David are best known for being the band that had Justin Broadrick as their drummer in between him leaving Napalm Death and then concentrating fully on Godflesh. Also, most 90s metal fans of around my age probably know them as the band that wrote Dog Day Sunrise that Fear Factory covered on Demanufacture.
Yes, I was about to mention that. That is my... I was going to say that's my experience with them, but I think I've actually seen them live at Supersonic, so
awesome.
I am lying. Pretty sure they played Supersonic one of the years I was there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a bit of a rough lo-fi live recording, but you can still tell that there was a hell of a lot of power coming from that stage.
Yeah.
If you were in that room, it would have been loud as fuck. It
horrifically loud.
Reminds me of early Swans in parts, but it's a bit more metallic.
Yeah.
There's a studio version of this just called Roadkill on Dust Bowl, which is their debut record, which is, it's still great, but it's a lot more restrained.
Yeah.
And therefore less exciting and heavy. It's still good.
Yeah.
But this is insane. I know, Tracy, you've mentioned Head of David a fair few times when we've been doing the other podcasts. Are they a band you were particularly into at the time?
I didn't know them that well, actually. I always loved this song, but it originated from having this single, and I love the sheer noise and chaos of it.
Yeah.
I think I've mentioned them before because, famously, I wanted to see them at Reading 89, but managed to miss their entire set while queuing for the loos.
That was it. Yes, I do remember that.
I mean, I could kind of hear it because it was all just one big sight, Reading, then.
Yeah.
But, you know, I heard it from afar, which isn't great. It's not ideal. And, you know, and I didn't get to go and chuck myself around in the crowd, which is what I really wanted to do.
At least you remember that they played, though.
Yeah.
Not like Ramones, who...
They were second band on of the day, so...
Yeah.
And I only went to queue for the loos because third band would have been Loop, and so I definitely wanted to go to the loo before they were on.
I'd have chosen Head of David over Loop any day.
Yeah, this is pretty fucking awesome.
It's great. Their albums seem to be fairly difficult to get hold of. I don't think any of them are currently in print as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
But they're on YouTube videos seems to be the best way to hear them.
Okie dokie.
Or the only way to hear them. Because they're not on Spotify or anything like that. Right, let's flip the 7-inch EP over and listen to side two then.
Okay.
Is Faith No More, a new improved song. This was recorded with the intention of appearing on Introduce Yourself. It was left off the final version of the album, but then re-recorded with completely different lyrics and vocals as The Morning After, when Mike Patton appeared. So it was on the real thing. Both versions are great. To me, this sounds like an exact hybrid between the early stuff. The bass, for example, is very similar to We Care A Lot.
Very, very, very.
Loads. Yeah. And faster disco.
And the later stuff, because the synth on it really sounds like some of the tracks on Angel Dust. Crack Hitler was what it was mainly reminding me of. It's great. I like it. It's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
I love Chucky's voice so much. I mean, this song, it's only Faith No More bottled. I thought it really is a mad mix between other songs, but somehow not quite as good. but I had to go and listen to Introduce Yourself last night, actually, because I haven't played it in a few years, and I love that album, especially Crab Song.
I don't know Introduce Yourself as well as... I think it's Anne's song on Introduce Yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, so I know Anne's song and We Care A Lot, basically. And I know them from the videos, because I used to have the VHS video collection.
Right.
Which was brilliant, because some of Faith No More's videos were amazing. Yeah, the video to Everything's Ruined is amazing because it's really low budget. It's just the band messing about in front of a green screen with various different other film footage being shown behind them.
But
it works amazingly, and it's one of my favourite music videos ever.
Whereas I don't really know Faith No More much after The Real Thing, but I was more into them for Introduce Yourself.
Yeah.
Because old.
Should we go for the final song on this particular release, but then we've got another one to talk about afterwards?
Yes, let's do that.
So this is The Godfathers and It's So Hard. Fairly sure that the title of this song alludes to how difficult it is to find any interesting information out about the band.
But I tell you what, the way he sings It's So Hard, it sounds like it's about something completely different.
So they're the only band out of all eight songs that we're covering today that I have absolutely no prior knowledge of at all. I don't think I've ever heard them mentioned in the music press. I've never heard any band cite them as an influence or seen them turn up on any lists of people's favourite band. In fact, I didn't think that I'd heard of them at all until I looked up what compilations that they'd been on previously and found out that I owned a track of theirs. There's a track called This Damnation, which is the first track on CD2 of the Children of Nuggets compilation, which is a box set that I really, really like and have listened to loads. But I have no fucking memory of that track at all. I know the next track. I'm absolutely fine with the next track, but that one particular song has never stuck in my head at all.
How strange.
This is all right. It's a nice bit of power pop, but it's not very interesting, particularly compared to the other three tracks that we've had already.
Yeah, basically.
It's not even a great representation of how they sounded, really.
Right, okay.
I really liked the band at this point. They just released the album Birth, School, Work, Death. And songs from that album would regularly be played down the indie nights I went to. Coventry clubs like Silvers and the Dog and Trumpet or Leamington Spa's Futrals and Buddies. Other stuff had, I don't know, more of an energy and a harder edge sometimes. But they were an odd band, really. They were very much part of the late indie 80s scene, but their image was much more suited and booted than scruffy indie kid.
Yeah, like kind the name like, and the like violin at the start. I was expecting something like Dropkick Murphys, and then I was underwhelmed.
Yeah,
they're fairly mod, aren't they?
No,
they've got the kind of mod sort of image.
They weren't mod at all. I've never. The band they came from, the brothers, Peter and Chris Coyne, were in a band before called the Sid Presley Experience. And Tim actually saw them live in 85, supporting Tim, my other half, saw them supporting Billy Bragg at the Powerhouse. He said, actually, when he was watching Billy Bragg, he stood next to Peter and Chris in the crowd. And he's got the 12-inch of their first single. This won't be popular on this podcast, I'm afraid. It's a cover of John Lennon's Cold Turkey.
Yeah, I don't mind it.
And that's me ducking from Ian's opinion of John Lennon.
I've said all I need to say about John Lennon, the wife-beating, child-abusing cunt.
Yeah. but no, they were weird because they wore suits, kind of a bit like Gallon Drunk later on in the 90s, you know, sort of much better dressed than all of us scruffy weeks.
Doesn't necessarily make good music, though, does it?
No. I mean, I did listen to some of the Birth, School, Work, Death album last night, and it sounds pretty dated now, actually.
It just reminds me of a Metallica T-shirt that one of my mates used to have that said Birth, School, Metallica, Death on it.
Yeah.
That's better than work.
I mean, I saw The Godfathers I saw them at Reading 88, actually, first time I saw them. And then I saw them sometime after that, but I can't remember where or when. And then I saw them again at Rebellion 2017 after they'd reformed. They were headlining one of the smaller stages on the Friday night, and it was really poorly attended. And Peter said on stage he wasn't feeling very well either.
Yeah.
And didn't really want to play the gig. I felt so sorry for him. And then the next day, just wandering around the festival, I bumped into him, not literally. But I saw him, and so I said hello and said that I'd really enjoyed the set. And he seemed quite touched that I'd taken the trouble to tell him. It was a nice moment.
Good. Right, so Tracy, that is the end of the first record that we're talking about. Next one is a CD, which is what we're a little bit more used to. But yeah, what is the one that you've also chosen for us to talk about?
It's from 1992, so not much further on. And it's a release that was with Melody Maker to coincide with the Roller Coaster Tour.
Yes, it was. The Roller Coaster EP from March 1992. So, March 1992 music news. Kurt Cobain marries Courtney Love. Prince wins the Heritage Award for Lifetime Achievement at the 1992 Soul Train Awards. And a judge in Chicago approves cash rebates of up to $3 to anyone who can prove that they bought Milli Vanilli recordings prior to the beginning of the lip-syncing scandal in
Amazing.
November 1990.
$3.
Yeah, I'd love that. Albums released that month: Curves, Doppelganger, Ride, Going Blank Again, Tool, Opiate, The Church, Priest Equals Aura, White Zombies, La Sexosisto, Devil Music Volume 1, They Might Be Giants, Apollo 18, and PJ Harvey's Dry. On tour, Manic Street Preachers, Soundgarden, supported by Corrosion of Conformity, Lou Reed, Rollins Band, the Roller Coaster Tour, as we've already mentioned, which was Blur, Dinosaur Jr., My Bloody Valentine, and Jesus and Mary Chain. And PJ Harvey was on tour, and we found in the exact issue of Melody Maker that did arrive in the post that me and Tracy were looking at the other day, that this exact week she played at Legends in Preston because Tracy was there.
Yeah.
UK number one single was Stay by Shakespeare's Sister.
Such a fucking tune.
Yes.
And the UK number one album was Divine Madness by Madness. In the magazine, on the front, there is Curve, The Cure and Cud, which makes me think that they probably chose the bands in alphabetical order to put on the cover of that particular issue.
Yeah, sounds about right.
There's also inside, there is a review of a Daisy Chainsaw gig where they were supported by Sheep on Drugs and also a theatre group called Elephant Witch, who seemed to very much annoy Ian Gittins, who was reviewing it. He was not happy about them at all. It's a scathing review of the supports, but Daisy Chainsaw got quite a good review out of it. Which is good, because I like Daisy Chainsaw.
Yeah.
Right, let's go for the first track on this CD then. So this is Blur and Resigned, demo version of the closing track on Modern Life is Rubbish, which was still over a year away from being released at this point. I do feel that this is probably a perfect example of what Ian doesn't like about Blur, because he's got Damon Albarn singing at his most lethargic. But Modern Life is Rubbish was always my favourite Blur record. Despite this being the closing track on the album, it makes a lot of sense that this was the sort of pre-release early demo track that they put out, because it's probably the closest track to their sort of shoegazy roots, just without the fucking baggy Hacienda bollock beats all over it that were all over like There's No Other Way and stuff like that on the debut. I always thought at the time, well, not at the time, I had no fucking idea who they were at the time. I always thought in the late 90s when I was reading about the Roller Coaster Tour that Blur were a really weird fit for the other three bands.
Yeah.
Who were the other three bands?
Dinosaur Jr., My Bloody Valentine, and Jesus and Mary Chain.
50% of a lineup I'd want to see.
Yeah. Britpop hadn't really taken off. Baggy and that kind of thing had sort of finished. It was a bit of a sort of hinterland between the two. And Blur were kind of shoegazy, so I could see why they sort of fitted on there.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was before they'd sort of embraced sounding like the Kinks and that kind of thing, which Modern Life is Rubbish. Most of that album is that kind of sound. You know, it's that and the first Suede record with a sort of really early start of Britpop.
Yeah, but I like Suede.
Yeah, but that's because it is mainly because Damon Albarn sounds like he doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
Whereas Brett Anderson puts a lot of effort into his vocals.
Precisely. Like, why the fuck should I listen to you if you don't even want to listen to yourself?
I think Damon's vocals on this one are really soft and inviting. I mean, you're right what you say.
Invitation to the most boring fucking sex you've ever had.
I mean, Colin's right. At this point, they were still kind of... They were filled with all that shoegaze potential still before they became full-on cheeky cockney geezers. I mean, I had my moments with Blur around this point. I've since become a total snob about them and think Damon's a complete cock. But I still love Graham. But back then, I really did like them. Although not enough to ever buy the records. I don't actually have a copy of that album. But no, this song is lovely. I mean, the melodica melody is so sweetly sad.
It's layered melodica as well. There's at least two or three tracks of it at the end, all sort of weaving over each other.
You know, it's basically like one 8-bar sequence that
repeated.
Just goes all the way through.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last two beats of the final bar of that is the, you know, the, just the, that two drum beat.
Yeah.
They're not content with just ripping off Wire and the Stranglers. Elastica basically stole that for a lineup.
Yeah. Elastica stole fucking everything.
I mean, Justine and Damon were together at this point, but...
I'm not sure if they were yet.
I think they would have been.
No, I think she was still with Brett.
Okay.
I think she was still with Brett Anderson
with
at
Bert.
This point. Yes. And then she got stolen rather than her stealing all of her songs.
Yeah.
Right. Before Ian gets too upset, let's go on to the next song.
Thank you.
So this is Dinosaur Jr. and a live version of The Post. Live version of a track from their Bug album that was recorded somewhere on their US tour in late 1991. It's released on about three different records other than this, and none of them seem to specify where it was recorded. It was later released as the B-side to their Out There single in 1993. At this point, it was exclusive to this CD.
See, the start of this song... sounds like a band that should have all of those amps and pedals, and then it goes into that chorus and it stops sounding like that.
So, this has never been one of my favourite Dinosaur Jr. tracks. It's just an album track that sort of you listen to while you listen to Bug, but it's never been one of the sort of highlights. They are the loudest band in the universe, as I've mentioned quite a few times. If there's ever any bits in our podcast that sound shit that I maybe should have picked up on the editing, it's Dinosaur Jr.'s fault. That's why I'm fucking deaf.
They're just shit loud.
They're good. I like them. But they were too fucking loud at that gig in Derby I went 2 years ago.
I mean, I didn't actually see them live until about 2017 because... I didn't go to any of the dates on the Roller Coaster Tour. And I don't know why. I'd have been living in Preston at that time, so the Manchester one would have been easy to get to.
Yeah.
But even though I went to a lot of gigs at Preston Student Union, I didn't go to so many Manchester ones. Probably I was too skint. And I'd seen My Bloody Valentine the year before in Manchester, so maybe I didn't go to this tour because I'm like, oh, well, I've seen... But I mean, I did love Dinosaur Jr. at the time. I mean, Bug is...
If you're like that, why the fuck do you keep going to see The Wedding Present?
Round of applause.
I'm not skint anymore.
I see.
Because I can afford it. Bug will always be my favourite Dinosaur Jr. album. You're right, The Post isn't the highlight from it, but I love the slow sludginess of this song. I mean, I'm imagining that's what Ian likes least about it.
No, you are incorrect. I like the slow sludginess the most.
Yeah. Ian likes stuff like Crowbar and Conan.
Yeah, I like things to be slow and sludgy. I don't like listening to Jay Maskus talk.
No.
At all.
In the Roller Coaster article in the copy of Sounds this was from, Damon actually said he was all excited about, he was feeling starstruck to be playing with Dinosaur Jr. And he said, I love the way that when Jay Maskus plays a guitar solo, he presses the pedal and it becomes twice as loud, so it washes everything out and you can't hear anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's already twice as fucking loud, though, before he presses the pedal. It's, you know, your ears are already fucking peaking at their full level. Everything is overloaded. It's an experience.
I wish I'd seen them live then, actually.
It's not a sensible experience, but it is an experience nevertheless. Try and see them outside if you can. I've seen them, every other time I've seen them has been at festivals, and there's space for the sound pressure to escape, and it doesn't hurt your ears as much. Right, let's go for the penultimate track.
Okay.
Tracy, do you know this one?
Yes, of course I do. You were joking when you said that, weren't
you? Of
course
I fucking was.
Jesus.
You're telling me what's
late night.
Carry on.
Sorry. This is My Bloody Valentine and Only Shallow.
There we go.
This is probably my second favourite My Bloody Valentine track after You Made Me Realise. I know I've mentioned it on Weedig Music, but when I first bought Loveless, I bought it secondhand on cassette from Entertainment Exchange in Nuneaton. And it's got such a weird, wavy sound where everything's warping in and out that when I first listened to it, I put it on my Walkman and chucked the batteries out and put new batteries in. And then the new batteries made it sound exactly the same, so I thought the tape was fucked and threw the tape away. And it wasn't until I got the CD about 4 years later that I realised it's supposed to sound like that. And then I got used to it, and it's great. But at first I was very confused.
It is a very unique sounding song.
Definitely.
Slash album, slash band.
Yeah.
It will remain in my top 10 albums forever. Loveless. It's a trademark. Kevin Shields guitar style, the glide guitar.
Yeah.
I watched a documentary he did in 2018 to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Jazzmaster.
Yes.
And he said it was pure luck when he stumbled on that technique. He'd picked up a Jazzmaster where the tremolo arm was set unusually high, and he'd started playing around with it and putting it through reverse reverb.
Yeah.
And within 2 hours, he'd written the song Slow.
Yep.
That's when he first used that melted effect. But he stressed it's important when you're bending the chords a lot that you need them to come up into tune. He said if you just bend up and down a lot, that's a whole lot of wobbly nothingness.
Yeah.
But if you come into tune, your brain hears the tune where it should be.
Yeah.
And ignores the fact that 50% of the time, he is out of tune.
Yeah, it's like how Lana Del Rey sings. She bends up into the note each time.
Yeah, she does.
It's glide singing is what it is.
Lana Del Glide.
Yeah, that's a pun. Oh, no, wait, it isn't. You just swapped a word.
It isn't. I mean, of course, when Belinda joined My Bloody Valentine, she didn't really play much guitar. She was originally intended to be just a backing singer. So Kevin taught her the tremolo on technique from scratch.
Yeah.
And she turned out to be really bloody good at it.
If that's how she first sort of learnt to play guitar,
yeah,
then, yeah, it's going to be intrinsic to her playing forever, isn't it?
Well, that's it.
Yeah,
and, you know,
it's probably shite at normal guitar playing.
But she's good at what she needs to do, which
is
fine.
Exactly.
So it's fine.
I mean, it's just a perfect opener to the album Loveless, though. I mean, it's just that mix of distorted guitars and swooning vocals. It's just perfect. The way it just makes you feel all woozy. And Robert Smith famously said on hearing Loveless, "They were the first band I heard who quite clearly pissed all over us." And that their album Loveless is certainly one of my all-time three favourite records.
Where? Yeah, I can definitely see that. Robert Smith has not only the best band in the universe that he's already in, but his music taste is fucking brilliant. Nearly all of the bands that he, like, brings on tour are bands that I absolutely love. You know, he'll bring Mogwai on tour, and he's had Nine Inch Nails do tours with him and stuff like that. He's just, yeah, he's like my music taste. Plus, he's also in The Cure, who are the best band in the world. So, yeah. Should we go for the final track on this CD?
Yes, let's see what it is.
Neatly bookending the episode, we've got another Jesus and Mary Chain track. This time it's Teenage Lust, which was a track from Honey's Dead, which is an album that I'm not really very familiar with at all.
No, me neither.
Apparently it was a big departure for their sound, but based on this it sounds quite similar to their other stuff for me.
No, it's a bit more sneery, a bit more like rock and rolly than...
Yeah, I do think... Yeah, the vocals are great on it. And at the end, there's the descending riff that I really dig. And it's got nice, clear drums again, so it's better than Psycho Candy.
I mean, I'm sorry to say that this is my least favourite track on the EP, and that's an EP that includes a Blur song.
Wow, a shit Blur song as well.
I can already hear people clicking the unfollow button on Twitter, but... I don't know, for me...
Not as much as they'll click the unfollow button when they hear what you said in the We Dig Music episode that's out in a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
No, perhaps not. but for a Jesus and Mary Chain song, I don't know, I just think this one lacks immediacy. I didn't really listen to Honey's Dead much either. I didn't listen to Mary Chain much at all after Darklands or Automatic at a push. But strangely, Reverence from Honey's Dead ended up being basically my most favourite of any of their songs, so...
Fair enough.
But it wasn't really until 2017's Damage and Joy that I truly fell in love with Mary Chain again.
Why did that one song from the album stick with you then? Is it one that you'd heard isolated from it from seeing them live?
No, I heard Honey's Dead a lot later.
Right.
Because I'd basically stopped listening to them. I think Reverence actually became my favourite song when I saw them live, because live it's
amazing.
That's
what I thought, yeah.
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 That makes sense.
But And then 2017's Damage and Joy, I loved because it went right back to that 60s girl band sound. It was Psycho Candy, but with really good production.
That's what Psycho Candy needs, because the songs are great. It's the Husker Du thing. The songs are fucking brilliant. They just needed to be recorded better so that they're listenable. Because I think it's one of the greatest tragedies ever that Husker Du have recorded their albums to sound like that when the songs are so fucking good.
Yeah. Absolutely. I get that about Husker Du, but...
Yeah. But you're cool Mary. With it with Jesus and Mary Chain.
Well, yeah, because, the vocals are there. It's just, you know, it's like noisy undercurrent rather than just a big, badly produced pile of shit with good songs covered in the turds.
Nice.
But I mean, I so wish I had been to one of the dates on this tour. I was talking to Wilgie on Twitter, and he said he went to the NEC date of this tour. He did like Blur, even when it wasn't cool, too. But he did say the Valentines were the best of the night.
Awesome.
Another thing Kevin Shields said in the article in Melody Maker that accompanied this, he said he was really looking forward to the tour, and he said, will we be joining each other on stage? Are you serious? No, there'll be no holding hands or doing each other's songs. We're not celebrating each other. He also, though, said, hilariously, there'll be no new material from us on Rollercoaster, because except for the month off we had after the last tour, we've had no time to write since we finished Loveless. Maybe later this year we will. We need to get a new album out next year. That's the priority, as opposed to waiting another 3 years.
And how many years was it before MBV came out?
Something like 17.
I believe it was, yes. Like you said earlier when we were talking about him, that he'd written a song in 2 hours. It's like, that must be the fastest he'd ever done anything.
Yeah.
This is brilliant.
Right, so that brings us to the end of the Rollercoaster EP. So, Tracy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me back on.
That's all right. We've been nagging you for ages. You've been too fucking busy.
I know.
Is there anything that you'd like to plug? For example, our other podcast?
Yeah, I'm on this other podcast with you two.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really good. And we've just recorded an episode for 1981, which is really good.
And what's the podcast called? Because you didn't even mention it.
It's called We Dig Music.
It is, yeah. Thanks, Tracy. thank you for joining us again. That's been ace. There is one other thing I'd like to plug. I've written my first ever fanzine article.
Oh.
There's a brilliant fanzine called Lunchtime for the Wild Youth. And they have just put out an issue entirely based on free cover mount tapes, CDs and flexi discs and records. So if you're listening to this podcast, which you are, because you're listening to it now, that's what's in your ears at the moment. Most likely you're interested in that kind of thing. So you should get it and read it. It's also, there's an interview with Andrew Harrison, who used to compile the tapes for Select, and used to do CDs for Word and Mix Mag as well.
Well, you told me you were writing an article for a fanzine. You didn't tell me it was for Lunchtime for the Wild Youth.
I'm sure
that's,
I did.
No, you didn't. I thought it was someone else's. But that's Russell's fanzine, isn't it?
It is Russell's fanzine, yes.
Yeah, I've got some of his the early editions of that fanzine.
Well,
he's great.
It's a absolutely fantastic fanzine.
It is a great fanzine.
Everybody should read it. It's great. You can get it from lunchtimeforthewildyouth.bandcamp.com.
And his daughter does the artwork.
Yes, and it's very, very cool. But yeah, we've been through with this month's issue. Thanks for listening. Bye.
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 Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com. We Dig Music.
Hi, I'm Colin.
I'm Ian.
And I'm Tracy.
And we dig music.
Just not always the same music.
Each episode, we pick our 10 favourite songs from a specific year, rate them, and then battle it out over a top 30 countdown.
Colin's pretty enthusiastic about most stuff, Ian less so.
And Tracy definitely owns a thesaurus. And one of us will regularly be told to fuck off.
So join us each month to hear what we dig and what we don't. Listen to We Dig Music wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on WeDigPodcast.com or we're on the We Made This Podcast Network, which you can find at WeMadeThisNetwork.com.